Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of whether we are now entering not just a post-American but a post-Western era with China as Trump inflames Sinophobia and Xi Jinping stokes Chinese nationalism. Ambassador Chaz Freeman, a senior fellow at Brown University's Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs, who was the former director of Chinese affairs at the U.S. State Department and the principal interpreter during the late President Nixon's groundbreaking visit to China in 1972, joins us. With Putin and Xi Jinping appearing to get along like new best friends at the economic summit in St. Petersburg, we will assess whether the opening Nixon made with China, which put the U.S. in the catbird seat playing the USSR off against the PRC, has now been reversed. And we will discuss the recent talk Ambassador Freeman gave at the Freeman-Spogli Institute for International Relations at Stanford on hostile coexistence with China, and look into whether Trump's erratic hostility to China in pursuing a trade war to get them to cry uncle will work. The Chinese apparently believe this is an integrated U.S. strategy, which it is not, because Trump is all about government by stunt to sow chaos, then fix a problem he has created to make himself look good, look like a hero to get reelected in 2020 in order to stay out of jail. Then we'll speak with Raul Hinojosa Ojeda, who is the founder and director of the North American Integration and Development Center at UCLA and one of the people who originally proposed the North American Development Bank, which Mexico's President López Obrador is using as a vehicle to enact his part of the bargain he struck with Trump months ago in spite of Trump's sudden reversal of his tariffs threat over the weekend, claiming victory in solving a crisis Trump created. Raul attended the Defense of National Dignity rally in Tijuana that López Obrador held on Saturday, and we will examine whether the Trump administration will follow the Mexican president's advice to address the immigration problem at its root in Central America by making life more livable for the people in the countries from which asylum seekers are fleeing. Then finally, we'll examine further the border issues which Trump appears to be deliberately exacerbating to rally his base, at the same time address the real and growing humanitarian problem that the U.S. has not been able to solve, which Trump is trying to make the much less resourced and capable country of Mexico responsible for. Guadalupe Correa Cabrera, a professor of public policy and government at George Mason University and the president of the Association of Borderland Studies at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, joins us. The author of Los Zetas, Inc., Criminal Corporations, Energy, and Civil War in Mexico, she will try to separate manufactured problems from real ones. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Ambassador Chaz Freeman, a senior fellow at Brown University's Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs. He was Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs from 1993 to 1994, earning the highest public service award of the Department of Defense for his roles in designing a NATO-centered post-Cold War European security system and in establishing defense and military relations with China. He also served as U.S. Ambassador to Saudi Arabia and as Deputy Chief of Mission and Chargé d'Affaires in the American embassies in both Bangkok and Beijing. The former Director for Chinese Affairs at the U.S. Department of State, he was the principal American interpreter during the late President Nixon's path-breaking visit to China in 1972, and he recently gave a talk at the Freeman-Spogli Institute for International Studies entitled On Hostile Coexistence with China. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ambassador Chaz Freeman.
Glad to be with you.
Well, thank you, Ambassador. And today's New York Times has a lead article suggesting that the whole border crisis with Mexico over Trump's threat to impose tariffs to punish Mexico for not stopping the flow of immigrants. It turns out apparently the deal was struck months ago and that this is sort of government by stunt. A reality TV way of ginning up a phony crisis and then solving it to make yourself look like a hero and help get reelected. Is that mechanism also at play with China?
I think it is, actually. I think the article you're referring to, or perhaps it's another one in the New York Times today, a very good article by
Peter Baker,
Columbia University, Wertheim, Columbia University historian, makes the very valid point that the current crisis in U.S.-China relations has more to do with American anxieties than with anything the Chinese have done. It is, it seems to me, in part a manipulation of public opinion for purposes of electoral standing. Unfortunately, Mr. Trump doesn't preside over any sort of unified view among his subordinates, and so we have multiple incompatible agendas at work in the trade talks, which is one of the main reasons they've not just failed, but metastasized and basically contaminated every other element of our relationship.
Well, we, of course, under Trump, have the American First proposal, plan, agenda, whatever you want to call it. So it's a little bit disingenuous to be upset that the Chinese are, putting themselves first. But you mentioned in your article, let me just quote this, "Meantime, the ineptitude of the American elite revealed in the 2008 financial crisis, the regular eruptions of racial violence and gun massacres in the United States, the persistence of paralyzing political constipation in Washington, and the arrogant unilateralism of America First have greatly diminished the appeal of America to the Chinese elite." How about the Chinese people in general, albeit that they live in a police state under censorship? Is there a detectable change in their attitude? I understand they're no longer buying iPhones for patriotic reasons. Well, they're buying the cheaper Chinese version.
Actually, some of the Chinese phones are at least as good or maybe better than iPhones, which is part of our problem. That is, we are facing a competition with a country that is enormously competent in some respects, and which has eight times as many scientific, technological, engineering, and mathematics workers as we do, and which is producing more at three times the rate we are. So I think the attitude of the Chinese toward us really did begin to change in 2008 with the financial crash engineered by the wizards of Washington. And some Chinese, quite wrongly, I think, came to the conclusion that there wasn't much more to be learned from the United States or from the West in general. And a touch of hubris and arrogance, which had not been present, began to infect their attitude toward the world. Mr. Trump's erratic behavior and the deluge of vituperative comment out of the political elite in Washington, not, by the way, in the states, but in the federal capital, have thoroughly turned off Chinese on the United States. And the most recent development was a caution by the Chinese government to parents and potential students in American universities to think twice about coming here for a whole series of reasons, including racism and discrimination and abuse by the security agencies, among the FBI. So the relationship is clearly on a psychological level in a rapid stage of deterioration on both sides.
And again, I'm speaking with Ambassador Chas Freeman, who's a senior fellow at the Brown University's Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs. He was the former director of Chinese affairs at the United States Department of State and was the principal American interpreter during the late President Nixon's pathbreaking visit to China in 1972. And he recently gave a talk at the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies entitled On Hostile Coexistence with China. So given that China still is a defender of free trade and the Trump administration is all about mercantilism, if not crony capitalism and self-dealing. What do you mean by we are now entering not just a post-American but a post-Western era with China?
Well, the rules of the international order derive from the era of European imperialism and colonialism, followed by American ascendancy, which reinforced those rules and somewhat changed them. I think, by and large, they're pretty good rules. The Chinese think so. They are, like everyone else abroad, distressed that the United States has decided, apparently, to abandon the order that it itself created and no longer apply the rules to itself, even as it sometimes continues to demand that others follow them. So the United States has pulled out of multilateral organizations. The Trump administration is trying very hard to hamstring and incapacitate the World Trade Organization, which has been the principal mechanism for orderly dispute settlement in economics internationally. We dropped out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which was then rather ironically picked up by Japan, which was trying to organize its own economic sphere of influence again to counter China. We are just not participating in more and more international rule setting, and we deviate from others in our interpretations of the rules and our willingness to implement them.
Well, it would seem that, in retrospect, that Trump, of course, pulled out of the TPP in the, I think, about the first week, along with the Paris Accords, and then, of course,
the first day, actually.
It was the first day. So that, to my mind, was more of not so much a trade arrangement, but a geopolitical arrangement in order to get the neighborhood organized so that to force China to play by the rules. And it seems detectable that since TPP was withdrawn, Xi Jinping has been able to move towards more towards a cult of personality and stoking nationalism and materialism and China first, if you will. Is there a correlation there?
Well, I think that you're correct that TPP was more geopolitical than trade-driven. In fact, I thought it wasn't a very good arrangement at all. But on the other hand, it was the mechanism we chose to sustain our presence and credibility in Asia, the credibility of our continuing involvement, and we just threw it away. We are now in a position where we're devoting our time and energy to defending American primacy in Asia, but we ourselves have undercut that primacy. I don't know that there's a connection to internal developments in China. I think the Chinese, in due course, would naturally become less passive and less inclined to avoid reacting to provocations from abroad. And they, from their perspective, they see a lot of provocations. The U.S. Navy is prowling just off their coast, very aggressively patrolling, transiting the Taiwan Strait, which is an international waterway, but doing so in a way that makes it clear that they're cocking a snoot at China. We are engaged, obviously, in trying to smash Chinese companies. We've connived in the arrest of Chinese corporate executives. We are trying to cut China off technology. We're trying to limit what Chinese students in the United States can study. And the whole thing, I wouldn't say it's a Cold War, but it's definitely a deep chill that is setting in. And I think that has some impact on China, but I think the Chinese are simply proceeding on their own course internally and politically rather than reacting much to us.
And do you see broader changes underway, as I mentioned in the opening, that you were there translating for Nixon and Mao in 72, and that initiative, opening of Nixon's, of course, put the U.S. in the catbird seat, being able to play off the USSR against the PRC. Are there any indications to your mind from the kind of love fest between Xi Jinping and Putin on Friday in St. Petersburg at the Economic Summit? Do you think that arrangement that put America in the catbird seat has been reversed?
Well, I think we've done that to ourselves. I mean, we've been pushing hard against the Russians in Europe with the expansion of NATO and the proposed addition of Ukraine to NATO, which is something that definitely crosses the Russian red line when we knew about that. And we've been pushing on the Chinese from the other direction, and we've pushed the two of them together. I don't think this is an alliance between Moscow and Beijing, but it is an entente, that is a limited cooperation for limited purposes, perhaps for a limited time. And both sides are approaching things very, very pragmatically. And they're finding a lot of things to cooperate on. Among the things they talked about in St. Petersburg was a joint project for heavy lift troop transporting helicopter. They're working on a wide-bodied jet to compete with Airbus and Boeing. They are looking at a whole series of military projects. Russia is involved in building multiple nuclear reactor, nuke power stations in China. The two are more and more engaged in joint exercises of one sort or another in the military sphere. So they have the best relationship those two countries have ever had. And this is a result of Chinese policy that goes back to the collapse of the Soviet Union. The Chinese very explicitly decided then that eventually Russia would come back, and when it did, they wanted it to be a friend, a partner, rather than a hostile or an enemy. And they've succeeded with a great deal of help from us. I think the Russians were reluctant, but we left them with nowhere to turn but to the Chinese and to a bit to the Turks.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, Ambassador Freeman, turning to the real problems, which there are between the U.S. and China, particularly with intellectual property theft, which concerns American business, you've pointed out there is a cultural difference here that perhaps we don't understand, that in Chinese culture, copying somebody's work is a form of flattery. So explain that, if you will.
Well, if you look at the history of Chinese art, for example, Chinese poetry, you'll find that successive generations revere and express their admiration for previous generations by copying elements of what they've done. And this is a very deeply ingrained tradition. But the modern world that has come to China is contrary to this, and the Chinese, I think, now very much understand the need for ownership of intellectual property, and they're actually becoming quite good at protecting it. The Chinese legal system is sometimes used now by Western companies who find it more efficient, less costly, and quicker to resolve disputes, most of which, by the way, if there are disputes between foreigners and Chinese, the foreigners have had the better batting average in the Chinese courts. So I think there's a disconnect here. The people around the Trump administration dealing with China are not themselves people who've done business in China. Mr. Lighthizer, the U.S. Special Trade Representative, is a trade litigator who was involved in trying to curtail Japan's growth in the 80s. And who hates multilateral institutions like the WTO. Mr. Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, is basically a mortgage banker, no experience dealing with trade as such. Mr. Ross, the Secretary of Commerce, is a scavenger of distressed assets, which he turns around and remarkets. And again, he's not been active in trade. Peter Navarro, the president's primary economic advisor on China, is widely regarded as a bit of a nut. He rejects Adam Smith and Ricardo explicitly. So he's very, very definitely mercantilist and also extremely anti-Chinese. So, you know, this isn't a complaint. The complaints have come from the business community, which have wanted the U.S. government to back them. But they never wanted the tariff war. They didn't want a trade war. They didn't want an effort to bring China down. If anything, they would favor an effort to build the United States up, make us more competitive, not try to level others, which I don't think will work in any event. We need to get our own act together, not try to damage China's.
Well, just in closing, does that come down to the elections in 2020?
If Mr. Trump is reelected, we're going to have more of this sort of rogue superpower behavior that is highly destructive of the world order. There will be more mercantilist, contradictory, and counterproductive moves in the trade area. He may retain a decent speaking relationship with Xi Jinping, but U.S.-China relations will continue their rapid decline. So I think there's no evidence to date that Mr. Trump learns anything from his mistakes. He doesn't even admit he makes mistakes. Everything is a magnificent success for him.
Well, Ambassador Chas Freeman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Ambassador Chas Freeman, who's a senior fellow at Brown University's Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs. He was Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs from 1993 to 1994, earning the highest public service awards of the Department of Defense for his roles in designing a NATO-centered post-Cold War European security system and in reestablishing defense and military relations with China. He also served as U.S. Ambassador to Saudi Arabia and as Deputy Chief of Mission and Chargé d'Affaires in American embassies in both Bangkok and Beijing, and he's the former director for Chinese affairs at the United States Department of State and was the principal American interpreter during the late President Nixon's pathbreaking visit to China in 1972, and he recently gave a talk at the Freeman-Spogli Institute for International Studies entitled On Hostile Coexistence with China. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back speaking with Raul Hinojosa Ojeda, who was in Tijuana on Saturday for the rally that called Defense of National Dignity, held by Mexico's President López Obrador. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Raul Hinojosa Ojeda, who is the founder and director of the North American Integration and Development Center at UCLA, where he researches the political economy of regional integration, focusing on Latin America. He was one of the people who originally proposed the North American Development Bank, which Mexico and the United States created in 1994. Welcome to Background Briefing, Raul Hinojosa Ojeda.
Great to be with you, Ian.
Well, thank you, Roland. You were in Tijuana on Saturday for the rally that López Obrador, Mexico's president, held. It was called Defense of National Dignity. The whole confrontation that preceded it turned out to be a reality TV stunt and a total fraud, in as much as the deal was struck, apparently, between Mexico and America back in December. But Trump ginned up this phony crisis threatening Mexico to rally his base. And I guess López Obrador was pretty clever not to take the bait, would you say?
Well, I think that they've been trying to walk a very fine line. On the one hand, they're really concerned that such a volatile and pyromanic president who loves to start fires and then pretend he's going to put them out. I think the interesting dynamic that's created by this news that most of these agreements had already been done way before this week's negotiations in Washington also allows the Mexican government to basically say, as the foreign minister Ebrard said, Mexico maintained its dignity intact in the negotiations in the sense that it basically reiterated that it is doing a number of things that had been announced in December and in the last couple of months, and did hold the line on what was the U.S.'s number one demand, which that Mexico accepted what's called the third safe country rule, which basically says that Mexico will accept refugees, asylums, in lieu of them being able to apply for asylum in the United States. That would be a violation of a number of international rules that Mexico has agreed to. So what they're saying is that, look, we're going to deploy a National Guard, which they had agreed to do, a National Guard in Mexico, which, by the way, hasn't even been created yet, really, and that they will deploy it on the southern border. When it was announced, it was originally to stop the violence and the drug trafficking in Mexico. Now that's a serious problem for Mexico. They're going to have to now try to do multiple things with an entity that doesn't exist. The other thing that they've agreed to, which again was supposedly already agreed to before, is that along the entire border, they are essentially, what they're saying is accepting the fact that the United States is going to violate its own law. That's up to them to return migrants without a full right to asylum and to see a judge, and basically just push them to Mexico and say, you know what, wait in Mexico. And Mexico is going to say, well, you know, we are under obligation that if people arrive in our country, we're going to try to take care of them. And the problem is that's going to be a lot of people. And Mexico is committing itself to, quote, create jobs, education, housing, and health care for those while they presumably are being kept out of the United States. Now, this is being adjudicated in the courts whether that's even allowed, but the judge has allowed this to go forward. So this is going to be a serious problem on the Mexican side. There are, at latest count, you know, we're looking at about 300,000 family members detained just this fiscal year on the southwest border, most of them from Honduras, Guatemala, and they're if Mexico does agree to basically again follow its own rules and try to humanitarian reasons take care of these folks, there's going to be a very serious problem. It's simply of capacity. So I think that the danger, of course, here is that Donald Trump is now excited about using these tariff war tactics. Some people, you know, call them, you know, this is clearly extortion. But it's a strange type of extortion, since the United States will put a gun to its own head if it tries to do this tariff actual implementation. But it would also be devastating for the Mexican economy. The people that were in Tijuana at the rally were a number of senators and congressmen had spoke at UCLA on Friday, where we released our research that showed that if, in fact, these tariffs went into effect and Mexico retaliated, which it probably would have to, the trade war would be devastating, probably the worst economic depression in Mexico since the last century. And obviously extremely difficult for the United States, very difficult, particularly in the areas of the country that strongly voted for Donald Trump, what I call soy land, which would be very hard hit. So Donald Trump, people are very worried that we've set up a situation where in 90 days they're going to review this, progress on does this actually result in a reduction of immigration to the border? And if it doesn't, they said, well, the tariffs are only temporary. They can be suspended. They can be reinstated at any time. I think so the problem here is that they're facing a deadline over the next 90 days as well for the approval of the new U.S.-Mexico-Central America trade agreement. Canada trade agreement. And Trump, I think, was also realizing that he is in trouble. He's not being able to pass this in Congress. So he's going to try to create some type of, I think, ongoing theatrical exercise here, where he's showing that on the one hand, he's being tough and pushing Mexico. Mexico has already said, look, we're going to approve this agreement, the trade agreement. But he can't seem to get his the Congress to be able to go along at this point. So the issue is, will there be any possibility of a movement towards a more sane policy over the next few months? I mean, the other thing we discussed at UCLA on Friday is that, in fact, this North American Development Bank that helped create, which has spent $9 billion, actually, on creating environmental infrastructure along the U.S.-Mexican border, precisely as an alternative to pure free trade or building of walls, creating of the zone an area of ecological, sustainable, and better productivity for the region. It's been successful. It's the only institution that exists between the United States and Mexico as a treaty that they've agreed in principle to reauthorize more funds, which would be great. Now, the problem is that all of this is being held hostage by the tactics of the Trump administration. And the idea that's being proposed is that the bank, which was originally conceived of to address also employment problems of a displacement in the United States, which it successfully did, on the Mexican side was supposed to address root causes of migration, which was never implemented. So there's an opportunity here to try to redefine the discussion. The one thing that's missing in any of this is really some serious attention to root causes, not only in Mexico, but in Central America. There is an instrument out there that could potentially do that. It's been approved by the legislatures of both countries. Now they just have to fund it, and that could be an element of a new type of a broad deal that would include also Central America. That's what the Mexican government would want. It's not clear that the U.S. government is focused on sustainable solutions, but rather probably keeping this issue alive based on how Trump thinks it's going to play out politically for himself. And that's what everybody is very worried, that they are basically held hostage by his political whims and fate at this point.
So do you think that given that a part of the bargain between President Trump and President López Obrador of Mexico is to deal with the root causes, I don't know whether that's for real in terms of our side following the Mexican president's advice to address the immigration problem at its root in Central America by making life more livable for the people in the countries from which asylum seekers are fleeing. The United States under the Trump administration has actually cut funds that had been allocated for that very purpose in Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. Where does that stand? Is there any indication that López Obrador has been able to get Trump's attention on that very logical point that, you know,
Right. Well, I mean, what is interesting is that the first meeting that they had on this issue in December at least it was put on the table, and there were big pronouncements made of billions of dollars. $30 billion was thrown out as a number that it was an aspirational goal. I mean, the problem is right now that they have really no idea how to do that and a mechanism to make something like that happen. In fact, most U.S. AID assistance, which I've studied in Central America, virtually none of it actually is directed toward job creation in immigrant-sending areas. Most of it is actually security aid or some type of infrastructure spending, which is usually ending up supporting currently competitive and private sector projects in the region. So very, very little of it is really specifically designed to address root causes, creating opportunities in the immigrant-sending areas. What we've been talking about with the Mexican Senate now and with members of the Hispanic caucus in the U.S. Congress is to use the fact that there's $50 billion a year in remittances, okay, every year to Mexico and Central America, most of it, in fact, to southern Mexico at this point, and the idea is to use new technologies that are able to capture this, reduce the cost of remittances significantly and allow people to save money in the type of a savings bond that could then generate possible funds for investment, working with local microfinance institutions, something much more rooted in actually addressing the root causes. Now, there's a logical idea for you. The NADBank, North American Development Bank, is on record saying that they would like to be able to play that role. It's unclear right now whether there's enough understanding of this issue in Congress to be able to then make sure that it is included in whatever deliberations are done with the U.S.-Mexico Canada trade agreement. I mean, I think part of the problem is that the United States and actually, for that part, Mexican government have been incredibly negligent in understanding that needs to be managed. A migration pattern, which, by the way, produces incredible amounts of wealth for the United States. All right. It's important to understand that undocumented migrants in the United States contribute literally hundreds of billions. Our estimate is close to about $1 trillion in GDP annually inside the United States. OK. And to fight and to try to deport people and reduce that migration will hurt the U.S. What needs to be done, obviously, is a comprehensive immigration reform policy that would allow them to be much more productive members of the U.S. Society and economy, and then to use these resources that are related already through remittances as the detonating force, as was done in the European Union, by the way, for a long strategy of sustainable development in the immigrant-sending areas, which, by the way, is where people come from and send their money back to. But we have failed to do this on both sides of the border. López Obrador is now taking seriously the ideas that something along these lines has to be done, even though it will come up against the interests of private companies who make a lot of money right now in the cash remittance business. But the technology is now at such a point, and he has made a lot of commitments that he's going to try to push these type of technology forward as part of a mechanism. The question is this obviously is not going to eliminate Donald Trump's short-term problem of ending immigration on the border anytime soon, within the next 90 days for sure. But and the question is, can people focus on what is an interesting opportunity to rethink trade, migration, and remittances in the region in a way that is clearly a potential win-win that has been ignored for so long And I think with the problem also, frankly, is that López Obrador didn't want to make U.S.-Mexico an important priority for him. He, in fact, has been downplaying the Mexico's international role. He's proud of the fact that he hasn't traveled abroad in a couple of years and didn't have a passport for many years. It's not exactly the best attitude to what is actually required, with a very engaged, intelligent relationship now with this complicated problem in the United States, with a lot of allies, the Latino community in the United States, a lot of people that are now extremely upset by this immigration issue, could be a detonating force for demanding a long-term solution. If those voices are not heard, if those members of Congress don't stand up now and act intelligently with Mexican counterparts, I think we could lose this opportunity and also fall into what would be a really deep, vicious cycle of attempts to go back to this well, the Donald Trump, this poisonous well of the tariff threats. And next time, he may have no choice but to stay with it. He's thinking that that's his only salvation, because I think the reality of it is, if you look at the numbers, the irony is that migrants' caravans have been around for many years, and they by the way, they typically peak around this time of the year, before the rains come, before it becomes too hot to cross the desert in the Southwest. But this year, we are seeing in the last 12 months a huge surge from families, particularly from El Salvador, mostly Guatemala and Honduras, coming to the border. I actually trace it back to a year ago when Donald Trump started tweeting about the caravan, which ironically made the issue much more prevalent for everybody to understand. And within a week time, the number of people in the caravan went up 1,000%. And has been growing since then. In other words, people are now seeing, wait a second, this might be an opportunity for us to, as a family group, to get to the border and to try to see if we can get some type of an asylum. Many people hadn't considered that. And in a way that they avoid paying coyotes if they move in caravans. So in a way, this is a part of a backlash to Donald Trump. He's trying to use the caravan issue. He's actually amplified its not only social media presence, but people have figured out this is maybe a chance to go forward. So he's again starting fires that he has to try to put out. But the problem with being a pyromaniac is that sometimes you can't control the fires you're setting up.
Well, Raul Hinojosa Ojeda, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Raul Hinojosa Ojeda, who is the founder and director of the North American Integration and Development Center at UCLA, where he researches the political economy of regional integration, focusing on Latin America. He was one of the people who originally proposed the North American Development Bank, which Mexico and the United States created in 1994. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back examining further the border issues, and we'll try to separate manufactured problems from real ones.
There's a place where I've been told every street is paved with gold, and it's just across the border line.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Guadalupe Correa Cabrera, who is a professor at the Shah School of Policy and Government at George Mason University, whose research focuses on U.S.-Mexico relations, organized crime, immigration, border security, and human trafficking. A global fellow at the Wilson Center, she was recently the principal investigator of a research grant to study organized crime and trafficking in persons in Central America and along Mexico's recent migration routes, supported by the Department of State's Office to Monitor and Combat Trafficking of Persons, the president of the Association of Borderland Studies, and a global fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Her latest book is Los Zetas, Inc., Criminal Corporations, Energy, and Civil War in Mexico. Welcome to Background Briefing, Guadalupe Correa.
Hello, hello, Ian. It's a pleasure being with you.
Well, thank you. And let's try and separate manufactured problems from real ones. There are real problems, as our previous guest, Raul Hinojosa Ojeda, said, but they are, to a large extent, exacerbated by the president, who appears to be using, in other words, do you believe that he really wants to solve the border issues, or does he want to inflame them to use them as a re-election tool to rile up his base?
Of course, it seems that he wants to use it. It seems that he wants to manufacture a crisis. And every time that he can, he wants to highlight that. And we're going to see that from here till the election. Maybe, you know, he creates that. He utilizes the media and he connects phenomena that are not necessarily together to continue building support, I mean, his base of support, to continue constructing it. And it's gonna be very harmful. And it has been harmful. It's good for him. It's not good for the country. There's a lot of uncertainty also within the United States.
But by increasing the cruelty of the treatment of these Central American migrants, now apparently he's cutting off English lessons for the children. They can't play soccer, can't go outside of these cages that they're in. This seems to be sort of a strategy, if you will, to basically punish people. And so somehow the word will get back that you're going to be treated very poorly in the country that you're fleeing to because you can't live in the country in which you were born.
Exactly. It's complicated. He's playing this game of deterrence. Deterrence through, giving this message, you're not welcome in the country. You're going to be mistreated. You're not going to be given any support. You're going to suffer. You're not welcome. However, the problem is that the push factors are so important, the extreme poverty, the gang violence, that people are willing to make the journey no matter what, no matter if they are detained for months in very horrible conditions, detention centers, freezers, put in cages, women are raped along the journey. It doesn't matter. It has not worked. If the conditions in Central America do not change and jobs are given in the United States, they know that this is going to be horrible. They're going to be living in the shadows. But still, there is a lot of what they can have here versus what they have in their countries. So if the president of the United States does not want that these people come to the country, he might want to do another thing to provide support to Central America. And also, if he does not want that these people are coming, you know, not criminalize them, but criminalize those who provide them with jobs, because incentives are so important. This is all play. This is all like a spectacle. This is all like an electoral game. The Democratic Party, the president, because we have also to understand that the conditions are not necessarily new. So this is very political. The issue of immigration, it's an issue that has to do with human life, but has been politicized to the extent that everybody uses or has been using this for decades, this issue.
So can Mexico, I mean, it seems so unfair that the country, the powerful country of the United States, the wealthiest country on the planet, can't solve its immigration problem, and Trump is trying to make Mexico responsible for a problem that the U.S. can't solve or hasn't solved yet. And Mexico, of course, is a poor country with nothing like the resources the U.S. has. So what Trump is doing now, he wants to dump all of these asylum seekers on Mexico and put them in limbo How is that going to be managed?
We don't know how that is going to be managed. We don't know how or which resources Mexico, Mexico has limited resources with regards to the agreement. There's no agreement of how, for example, in the case of Turkey and the European Union provided Turkey when they signed an actual formal third safe country agreement. So Turkey would process the asylum request from those who come from the south, from Africa, from Syria. However, in this case, we don't know how Mexico is gonna do this, how Mexico is gonna provide with support to migrants that are waiting for their asylum requests that are gonna be done in the United States, how they're gonna deal with this. I think that the United States, the Trump administration, the bet is to deter migrants from coming. But the conditions are so bad in their countries that they will continue coming. Mexico is going to pay a big cost. I believe also the negotiation power of Mexico. Mexico was put behind the wall, and they were not able to understand how Donald Trump negotiates, how he threatens, how he can impose tariffs. Mexico probably could have been decided to do something else. But as well, Mexico is pressured and is behind the wall. It's just in a very difficult position to negotiate under some unequal circumstances. But we don't know how Mexico is going to do it. Mexico does not have the resources. There's no agreement. The United States is just like leaving the problem to Mexico, just dumping the migrants in Mexico. Migrants that not have place in their country or in the United States, Mexico is left like a sandwich, you know, pressured by the poverty, by the conditions of Central America, and by a very, country that's not helping, and it's just leaving the problems to Mexico.
Well, there's a very alarming article on the front page of Sunday's New York Times. A Drama of Trump's Own Making Ends with a Familiar Hero by Peter Baker. And he quotes a former CIA official who was on Obama's National Security Council, Ned Price, saying, "This is a pattern we've seen since the first days of this administration. The president manufactures a crisis, galvanizes his base around the challenge, leaves the definition of success undefined, pretends to play hardball, and, lo and behold, finds a solution that entails little more than window dressing, if that. For Trump, it's a win-win, but the loser tends to be the American people, oftentimes Trump's base first and foremost." Do you think that there's any chance that the people that live in the Fox News bubble, that are constantly deluged with pernicious propaganda that basically says black is white and white is black, up is down and down is up, do you think there's any chance that people will start noticing this pattern?
Yes, they have to understand that in the end, right? Exactly what's happening today, the president is harming his own country, his own country, with uncertainty. How the markets are going to work in the long term? Probably today they don't feel any difference. They are living with the propaganda. But in the long term, in the medium term, they're going to realize that they have not achieved anything, that the reasons why they voted for that change or something different are not there, are just an illusion, smoke and mirrors. It's just like, it's very damaging for the whole country, for its leadership capacity, for his, as a moral leader of the country, really the harm that Donald Trump is doing to his country with the uncertainty, with the division, dividing the country between two extremes is really bad for any country that pretends to continue being the hegemonic power of the world. In terms of the image that it's giving to the world, and the problem is that, you know, you see a little bit of economic growth, but how much is this going to continue? When you threat that way, the market stops, and it damages the economy as well. So we'll see, and I'm sure that people are going to see that the reasons what they voted for Donald Trump, for a different leader, for the disruptor, are not materializing. People are people can be, moved by the propaganda, but not forever. And this is very worrisome.
But do you think, just in the last couple of minutes, Guadalupe, that that given that Trump's message here is pretty blatant to his white base, which is, you know, the Democrats only care about brown and black people, and I'm your champion, and we're going to try and stop these hordes of people invading our country. That's his message. It's obviously from the day first utterance when he started to run. On his first day, he demonized Mexicans as rapists and murderers. Are the 30 million Americans of Latino descent here in the United States, are they going to vote? Because if Trump's riling up his white base to vote, conversely, is it going to motivate the Latino vote?
It's a very difficult question, because if you are attentive to the polls, and it also has to do with the candidate of the Democratic Party. It seems to me that he's really playing a very smart game right now. It's not that those who are not white and are from Mexico's descent or from Central America's descent. So many of them are voting for Trump. This propaganda works not only for white America. This propaganda is working also for those who pretend to be white America, even though the color is not white. It's very interesting and very complex, but the propaganda has helped Donald Trump to maintain a very important base of support. And if the Democratic Party is not capable of coming with a candidate of unity, you have so many possibilities, and you come up with a weak candidate, Donald Trump can win the election. It's just the term is small steel for people to realize that they are not achieving anything. There is a time when they can live with propaganda, and it seems that 4 years are still a time when Donald Trump can still manage his discourse, his divisive discourse. So it's very, very, very worrisome. And I'm not sure that people are going to go out and vote against Donald Trump just because they are Latinos or they are African Americans. There are many Latinos that are voting for Donald Trump and support Donald Trump because they are also subject to his propaganda.
Well, Guadalupe Correa Cabrera, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Oh, thank you very much for having me, Ian. It's a pleasure.
Likewise. And again, I've been speaking with Guadalupe Correa Cabrera, who is a professor in the Shah School of Public and of Policy and Government at George Mason University, whose research focuses on Mexico-U.S. relations, organized crime, immigration, border security, and human trafficking. A global fellow at the Wilson Center, she was recently the principal investigator of a research grant to study organized crime and trafficking in persons in Central America along Mexico's eastern migration routes, supported by the Department of State's Office to Monitor and Combat Trafficking in Persons, the president of the Association of Borderland Studies, and a global fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Her latest book is Los Zetas, Inc., Criminal Corporations, Energy, and Civil War. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now. Lady dressed in white with a man.